Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the February edition of the Chemistry World Podcast with Mark Peplow, Victoria Gill, James Mitchell-Crowe and Onono Bhattacharya. I'm Chris Smith. On the way, longer-lived frozen food and smoother ice cream. And that's all thanks to a simple protein that we've all heard of.
A food scientist in the US has found that fragments from the protein gelatin could help to make food last much longer in the freezer and also get rid of that unpleasant crunchiness you get from ice cream.
More from Onono coming up shortly. Plus, we'll be hearing about the non-stick surface that you can turn on and off.
If you imagine the non-stick surface on your frying pan, imagine if you can just switch that on and off just with a switch. And that's exactly what scientists at Bell Laboratories in New Jersey in the States have developed.
And we'll also be finding out why the EU's plans for biofuels aren't very environmentally friendly.
The same wheat being turned into ethanol can give enormously wide variation from about 10% greenhouse gas mitigation up to 80 or even higher percentage, depending how it is processed and what fermentation technology and so on is used.
That's Martin Polyakov, who'll be telling us about the report written by the Royal Society on the EU's proposals for future biofuels. Also on the way is the answer to last month's chemical conundrum, where Mark wanted help answering this question.
Since natural gas doesn't smell, what's actually added to it to create the familiar smell of gas?
No idea? Well, the answer's on the way. And if you're one of the people who wrote in with the answer, keep listening to find out whether you're a winner, because we could be reading out your name later in the programme.
The Chemistry World Podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
First this week, all that glitters is not gold. But could it be silver, Victoria?
Yeah, so this is about iridescence. It's about the shine that you see on fish skin, which is actually really important to fish because it protects them from their predators. When they shine and they're swimming at shallow depths, which is when they're quite vulnerable, they just look like rippling water. And Israeli scientists at the Weizmann Institute of Science in Rehovot have studied the crystals, they're called photonic crystals, that fish grow in their skin that reflect light and produce this iridescence.
So this is the silver effect?
Yeah, exactly.
So what did they find?
They took a sample of the fish skin and looked at the photonic crystals on the underside of their scales in their skin, and they found that they're composed of guanine molecules, which is what they expected. So what they've done is they've compared guanine grown in the laboratory and guanine as it forms in the crystals in the fish skin. And it was quite a surprising result because crystals form in a certain shape or pattern because it's energy efficient for molecules to stack up in a certain way. The forces of attraction between each of the molecules are stronger in a certain direction, and that's what causes the crystals to grow. But in the fish skin crystals, they grow in the opposite way that they would have expected.
So this is a very energy inefficient process, potentially.
Yeah, exactly. They form into flat plates. So the fish are actually having to expend energy on forcing these crystals to grow in a certain way.
It's obviously worth spending the energy because it gives the fish this added evolutionary advantage that they're harder to see.
Yes, because these flat plates can stack up in layers. And what's important about that is that the thickness of these crystal plates and the distance between them corresponds with the wavelength of visible light. So as visible light goes into these crystals, it's disrupted and reflected back, which is what produces this iridescence.
Well, sounds brilliant, quite literally. Well, from fish that perhaps you could eat to a new form of antifreeze, which is eminently more edible than existing antifreezes on the...
Yes, that's right, Chris. A food scientist in the US has found that fragments from the protein gelatin could help to make food last much longer in the freezer and also get rid of that unpleasant crunchiness you get from ice cream that's been frozen and refrozen a bit too often.
But why is ice cream that's been repeatedly thawed and frozen crunchier like that? Because we've all experienced that and it's not very nice.
Yeah, once ice cream's thawed out and refrozen, you get large ice crystals forming. And that's what gives that horrible, crunchy texture.
So what's the new advance that's been discovered by these guys?
So what Srinivasan Damodaran did was that he used an enzyme to break down gelatin into small pieces, and then he found that these small pieces had antifreeze properties. I think this was a bit of a surprise, but in some ways it's not totally surprising, because many animals and insects also produce antifreeze agents, and many of these are very small proteins as well.
Do we get any insights into how those natural antifreezes that are known from the animals you describe, how they actually work?
Well, they think they know that these proteins bind to ice crystals when they're really, really small and somehow prevent them from getting any larger. How that works and how they actually stick to the ice crystals, that's not so clear at the moment.
So this gelatin breakthrough means that potentially we could start just adding the same ingredients as we eat already to foods, and they would not make these nasty ice crystals, and they would be much more flavoursome potentially.
Well, flavoursome may be stretching it, but yes, that's the idea. I mean, some companies like Unilever, for example, already include some of the antifreeze agents that they've got from elsewhere in their products. The problem has been that to produce them in large quantities, they've resorted to GM yeast, and that's not been very popular with some consumers.
Unpalatable with some people, a bit harder to digest. But obviously this is not going to go down too well with vegetarians, though, is it? Because gelatin, of course, comes from animals.
Yeah, well, that's true, but if you don't mind eating marshmallows or jelly, then you can't really have much of an objection to this.
So hard science is definitely alive and kicking, even if it is the science of soft ice cream. Thanks, Onono. On the way, how scientists have invented a surface that's non-stick at the flick of a switch, and also the chemical clues pointing towards Paris having had a tropical climate in the past. But first, to a tale that's over 100 years old. It's the story of how a charismatic chemist, John Young Buchanan, saved evolutionary biology from almost certain humiliation. In the mid to late 1800s, scientists believed that a jelly-like substance lurking on the seafloor that they'd called Bathybius held the key to all life on Earth. So it took a very sharp mind and strong self-belief to realise, and then to tell the biologists why they were wrong. To tell Buchanan's story, here's Richard Caulfield.
If you could have stood on the brow of the hill behind the English town of Portsmouth in late December of 1872, you would have seen below you a harbour crowded with warships. To the left would have been the men-of-war, the three-decked iron steamers of Her Majesty's Navy's new dreadnoughts and destroyers. To the right were the government offices, dry docks, cranes, piers and jetties. On this side, too, were the troop transports and official yachts. The central fairway would have been crowded with pinnaces, jolly boats, cutters and pleasure steamers. This was the nerve centre of the Victorian Navy. But what's that in the corner? Almost hidden by the gunmetal grey flanks of warships, you would have seen the three small masts of an unremarkable corvette, a ship tiny in comparison with the hulking leviathans around it, but one that was about to change the face of science forever. HMS Challenger. The objectives of Challenger's voyage, as agreed by the Royal Society and the Royal Navy, were fourfold. To investigate the physical conditions of the deep sea and the great ocean basins as far as the Great Southern Ice Barrier in regard to depth, temperature, circulation, specific gravity, and penetration of light. To determine the chemical composition of seawater at various depths from the surface to the bottom, the organic matter in solution and the particles in suspension. To ascertain the physical and chemical character of deep-sea deposits and the sources of these deposits. To investigate the distribution of organic life at different depths and on the deep-sea floor. There were five scientists aboard. Charles Wyville Thompson, Emeritus Professor of Zoology at the University of Edinburgh and the expedition's leader. John Murray, a fiery and outspoken Canadian, Henry Moseley, a naturalist at Oxford University, Rudolf von Willemoes Sum, a young German naturalist who had trained at the University of Bonn, and the most enigmatic figure of all, the expedition's chemist, John Young Buchanan. The Challenger expedition was largely focused on physical and chemical oceanography, but a significant part of its brief was biological. Darwin's theory of evolution had come out in 1859, carrying with it the caveat that evolution was driven by environmental change. This in turn implied that unchanging environments, such as the sea floor was thought to be, would harbour living fossils, organisms known only from the rock record on land. Consequently, Challenger was tasked with investigating whether or not the seafloor really was a silent landscape, where evolution proceeded very slowly amongst the unchanging vastnesses of the abyssal plains which were populated, like Conan Doyle's Lost World, with organisms that were known only as fossils from the sunlit realms above. Nothing highlighted the importance of this idea more than the concept of bathybius, the hottest topic in biology at the time. In 1868, Thomas Henry Huxley re-examined a sediment sample that had been taken by an Atlantic dredging expedition in 1857. He found that it contained a white, jelly-like substance. Examination of other deep-sea specimens showed that this material was found in most of them. Staining with carmine indicated that it was organic material. This led Huxley, after Darwin himself, the most famous biologist in the British Empire, to suggest that the floor of the ocean was covered in this substance, which he considered to be the most primitive living material on the planet. He named it Bathybius Haeckelii, after his friend, the eminent German biologist Ernst Haeckel. Haeckel took the idea even further, suggesting that not only was Bathybius primitive, but that it was nothing less than the missing link between life and non-life. The senior scientists aboard Challenger knew that an unwritten part of their brief was to find out more about Bathybius. But Wyville Thompson and John Murray were sceptical. Neither had ever been convinced that the material, notwithstanding the carmine staining, was truly indicative of life. And so, as the expedition set out, all hands were primed to look for Bathybius. Even diffident Buchanan, the chemist, knew this, as he wrote early in the voyage.
It was not only expected that the bottom of the sea would be found everywhere covered with a calcareous deposit, but it was believed to have been shown that the mud at the bottom of the ocean was everywhere associated with an all-pervading organism, to which Huxley, its discoverer, had given the name Bathybius.
Challenger's voyage lasted 4 long years, and as they sailed south through the Atlantic to Cape Town and then on to the vicinity of Antarctica and the Great Southern Ice Barrier, Buchanan and the naturalists aboard laboured to isolate Bathybius. Eventually, it seemed that they had struck gold.
Mr. Murray, who had been working according to the directions given by the discoverers of Bathybius, had actually observed a substance, like coagulated mucus, which answered in every particular, except the want of motion, to the description of the organism. As chemist of the expedition, I looked at the matter from a different point of view from that of the naturalists.
Buchanan decided to evaporate the water from fresh samples dredged from the bottom of the ocean, theorising that the residue of Bathybius would inevitably have to be left behind. But he drew a blank. Once the seawater had been evaporated, there was nothing left but a barely perceptible greyish powder without any sign of carbonisation or burning that might indicate the presence of organic matter. As Buchanan tested and tested, and as Challenger sailed from Australia up through the great volcanoes of the Dutch East Indies, he began to uncover a truth that, however unpalatable to the naturalists, excited him. He was beginning to realise that carmine staining was not uniquely diagnostic of life.
Haeckel relied chiefly on its faculty of being stained by carmine as evidence that the body which he was examining was organic. But sulphate of lime, as prepared by the precipitation of an aqueous solution of calcium salt by alcohol, is a perfectly amorphous flocculent precipitate which is coloured intensely by carmine, and the colour is first, as against treatment with spirit. The naturalists on board had great difficulty at first in believing that this reaction was not, as Haeckel had thought it was, absolutely decisive of the organic character of the body.
Eventually, Buchanan was ready to tell the others that Bathybius was a myth.
There remained but one conclusion, namely, that the body which Mr. Murray had observed was not an organic body at all. And on examining it and its mode of preparation, I determined it to be sulphate of lime, which had been eliminated from the seawater, always present in the mud.
Bathybius was not an organism at all. It was a chemical artifact caused by the reaction of the preserving fluid with seawater. Wyville Thompson and John Murray agreed that Buchanan's findings were conclusive. And, with some trepidation, Wyville Thompson wrote to Huxley to tell him that not a trace of his beloved Bathybius had been found. Huxley, not only a great scientist but also a gentleman of stature, realised his error and capitulated immediately and gracefully, withdrawing what he called the mistake in an article published in the journal Nature. Huxley never mentioned Bathybius again, although Haeckel was not as willing to give up his eponymous organism and continued to believe in it until his death. Eventually, HMS Challenger docked again at Portsmouth in May 1876, and the crew disbanded. Wyville Thompson died soon after of overwork, and it was left to John Murray to finish the 50-volume report of the voyage. John Young Buchanan took a lectureship in Cambridge for 4 years, but his heart was not in it. With an existing personal fortune and distaste for administration, he had no use for university life and spent the final years of the 19th century exploring the oceans of the world aboard the yacht of his friend Prince Albert of Monaco. He moved to America when the First World War broke out, and when it ended, returned to live out the rest of his life in a West End hotel. He died in 1925, the last of HMS Challenger's scientifics. His obituary reads, "He was not a man who made friends very readily, and he certainly did not wear his heart on his sleeve. But once a friend, you were always a friend, for he was a man whose quality of heart equaled the quality of his brain."
Oxford-based scientist and science writer Richard Caulfield telling the story of the expedition of HMS Challenger. The extract you've just heard is based on Richard's book, The Silent Landscape, The Scientific Voyage of HMS Challenger, which is out in the bookshops at the moment. The extracts from Buchanan's diaries were read by Ed Hutchinson. Thanks, Ed. Most of us own something non-stick, and it's a wonderful technology whether you're frying an egg or using chatter-free windscreen wipers. But now, Mark, scientists have come up with a Teflon effect that you can actually turn on and off.
That's right. If you imagine the non-stick surface on your frying pan, imagine if you can just switch that on and off just with a switch. And that's exactly what scientists at Bell Laboratories in New Jersey in the States have developed. The way that they've done it is to take the sort of materials that you'd normally find on a non-stick frying pan, fluoropolymers, and coated them over nano nails made out of silicon. Now, these nails look pretty much like the nails you'd find in your shed, apart from the heads are just 400 nanometers across. That's 200 times thinner than a human hair. Now, they line row upon row of these nails up on a surface, and they found that normally liquids, water, oil, all sorts, sort of bead up into droplets on the top. It's non-stick. But they found that when you add a current through this, where you put a voltage across the nano nails, the heads accumulate this electrostatic charge which pulls the liquids underneath the nail head, and that makes the liquid spread out across the surface, so the surface has effectively become non-stick.
So that sounds phenomenal, but why would you want to have a surface which would be selectively stick or non-stick?
Well, the scientists are proposing a couple of potential uses for it. One, they talk about self-cleaning surfaces. The other, which I think is probably more realistic in terms of realising it in the short term, is to use it in miniature laboratories, which many scientists are now working on, called labs on a chip. Now, if you imagine a laboratory that's the size of a postage stamp, you can do miniaturised science in a very efficient way. You can potentially have hundreds and hundreds of experiments going on just a normal bench. And what they would use the surface for in this would be to move liquids around. You can imagine if you have this surface which is either sticky or non-sticky, you move the voltage across that surface and it's going to help a droplet of water roll from one side to the other.
How easy is it to make, and therefore is this a scalable thing? Will we be able to make literally sheets of this stuff so that it's usable along the lines of what you've said?
At this stage, in terms of the manufacturing, yeah, they're sort of unique items. But if you look at how nano manufacturing has changed over the last decade, we've gone from a situation where many objects which 10 years ago were bespoke took 3 months for some poor grad student to make. Now you really are making them hundreds of thousands at a time, and it's automated. So I think it's only a matter of time before you really could churn these things out.
Well, nanoscale it might be, but a massive breakthrough it certainly is. And so is this, Victoria, which has strong promise for people who have burns.
That's right. This is early stage work, but it's really very exciting medically. This comes out of Sheila McNeill's group at the University of Sheffield. And Sheila McNeill is very well known for her tissue engineering work. She makes engineered skin for skin grafts, which are used to treat serious burn patients. So if your skin is destroyed by burns, you have new skin grafted onto your body. And obviously, the more extensive the burn, the less availability of healthy skin on your body there is to graft it on. So what Sheila McNeill's group do is they make the tissue-engineered stuff that's kind of like a store of using your own cells to grow skin. Now, there's a serious problem with skin grafts in that they shrink, and this is a particular problem in children. And the inflammatory process and the burn process seems to sort of contract up your skin. So although the graft might be successful and heal, you then get shrinkage of the skin on the actual wound. So at first, Sheila McNeill's group thought that this was just a big problem, but then they actually realised if they can look at why this works and start looking for drugs to combat it, then they've actually got in their tissue-engineered skin a perfect model to test it on.
Have they any clues as to why the skin does this?
It's a process of inflammation and healing and scarring, which has all sorts of complicated biochemical mechanisms. But one very important one that they've identified is the activity of an enzyme called lysyl oxidase. And what that does is it causes the collagen molecules in the deep layer of your skin to cross-link. And this cross-linking gives collagen its strength, but too much cross-linking seems to lead it to shrink up like this. So they've identified an inhibitor of this enzyme called 3-aminopropionitrile. If you apply this to the skin, it seems to prevent this cross-linking. So it inhibits the enzyme, stops the cross-linking, and it prevents the contraction.
That sounds good, but the one potential problem I can immediately think of is you wouldn't want that going everywhere in your body, because in the right place at the right time, that amount of cross-linking is ideal. So how do you confine the effect just to the skin?
That's the issue. And this is a really nice example of how the team have got together with another group of scientists in a different discipline. So they need a topical treatment. And another group in Sheffield, led by Steve Arms, are working on polymers that are specifically developed to be biocompatible so that you can put them onto your skin or even into your body and they won't harm you, they won't be toxic. So they got together with Steve Arms and he's developed a tri-block copolymer that's a perfect vehicle for their enzyme inhibitor. So you put the drug and your copolymer together, and the polymer gel releases the drug slowly, but over a reasonable period of time, over about 48 hours, and you have a good topical treatment.
When you apply this drug in their model on the skin in culture, what does this actually show when you subject it to sort of burn conditions?
Well, that's the really great thing, is that the model itself is tissue-engineered skin. It is human skin. So they've got this great three-dimensional model and they can burn it and show that it contracts in the same way that these skin grafts do. And when they burn their tissue-engineered skin, it contracts by about 80%. But when you apply the drug to it topically, it only contracts by around 60%. So they're getting a really significant result with their drug.
Very encouraging indeed, and we wish them luck with that as they move towards trials in real patients. Thank you, Victoria. And now on to a subject that seems to feature in almost every episode of the Chemistry World podcast, and that's biofuels. The EU have set some very ambitious targets for greenhouse gas emission reductions. In fact, by 2020, they want to see a 20% cut on the levels as they stood in 1990. They're proposing to achieve this, in part, with a drive for more biofuel use. But a report compiled recently by a group of scientists at the Royal Society argues that, and I quote, renewable fuels policies are encouraging biofuels that don't cut greenhouse gases and could cause social and environmental problems. Martin Polyakov, one of the scientists involved in drawing up the report, told me why.
Well, in the UK, at the moment, the use of biofuels is governed by the Road Transport Fuel Obligation, which describes biofuels merely that they come from a biological source and doesn't really put in any way a life cycle component to see whether something is actually cutting greenhouse gases or merely just coming from plant material.
So just because it's a biofuel doesn't necessarily mean that it's good for the environment?
No, because there are a whole series of issues. First of all, what you grow and where you grow it. For for example, if you cut down rainforests in Indonesia, which grow on peat, the act of cutting down the rainforest before you plant the palms that produce palm oil releases large amounts of carbon from the peat, which will negate any greenhouse mitigation from the fuel for many years to come. And then after that, the way that you actually process the fuel can also have quite a big impact. Some ways of processing fuel can be very much better than others. And if you look at Richard van Noorden's article in Chemistry World, you'll see that Jeremy Woods from Imperial College at the press conference explained that the same wheat being turned into ethanol can give enormously wide variation from about 10% greenhouse gas mitigation up to 80 or even higher percentage, depending how it is processed and what fermentation technology and so on is used.
So are you saying then that politicians in producing these guidelines haven't considered the facts properly and their science is flawed?
No, I don't think that their science is flawed. I mean, it's a good start, but they haven't really defined certification systems that need to be in place to decide whether you've got, if you like, a good biofuel or a mediocre one or even a bad one.
What's the definition then of a good biofuel?
Well, one which the preparation and so on of the biofuel, that's all the way from finding the land until getting to the petrol pump or the biodiesel pump, that you are actually saving the emission of greenhouse gases.
I think people have done some of these calculations and shown that it's all very well saying we're going to grow X amount of biofuels, but when you look into how they're going to get the kind of yields they need, they're putting lots of fertiliser onto the field, and this in itself is creating greenhouse gases. Is that the kind of thing you mean?
Well, yes, there is the point that if you put on nitrate fertilisers, they generate nitrous oxide, that's N2O, and that the agronomy of putting nitrate fertilizer on the ground and how this is converted into N2O by the bacteria in the soil is not entirely understood yet. That is, if you apply the nitrate in some conditions, depending when it rains and so on, you can get more or less N2O released. And N2O, which is a molecule that is similar to carbon dioxide, three atoms in a row, is a very much stronger absorber of infrared radiation and therefore is a much more potent greenhouse gas. So the same volume of N2O is more than 200 times worse for the greenhouse effect than the same volume of carbon dioxide.
So what guidance will you be giving politicians or hoping that politicians take on board in order to try to produce guidelines which encourage farmers to grow fuels that are the right sort of biofuels for the right sort of environment?
Well, there are several things that we've been recommending. The first thing is there's quite a positive message in the report that biofuels can make an immediate impact in cutting greenhouse gases, so that it's not that we have to wait some huge time before this can happen. The second thing is that we're going to have to be more selective about which biofuels that we use. For example, what the report recommends is that this renewable transport fuel obligation should include something about greenhouse gas reduction as well as, saying, biofuels. And the other thing, I think it is generally felt that if the length of time this obligation is in effect, that is reducing it from the current period, which I think is 10 years, to another up to, say, 20 years, will give much more time for sustainable biofuels to be developed.
Do you think that they're trying to do too much too soon without really considering the impacts then?
I think that there is enormous enthusiasm to get this in place, and that sometimes this enthusiasm has not been thought through perhaps as well as it could have done.
If you look at the targets, though, they're not trivial, are they? They want to produce by 2020 a reduction of the 1990 levels of CO2 emissions by 20%. I mean, that's a dramatic cut, isn't it?
Yes, it's an enormous cut. But I think that at the same time, what we've got to do is to put in the obvious engineering solutions to cars. For example, making more efficient engines, perhaps trying to reduce the weight of cars so that you're not trying to propel so much, and also to look at hybrid technologies and so on, so that we can reduce the demand at the same time as improving the sustainability of the supply, and therefore you can get reductions from both sides.
Nottingham University's Martin Polyakov explaining why the EU's biofuels policy urgently needs clarifying. And now, from worries about a warmer world in the future to evidence of a warmer Paris in the past, James.
That's right, yes, Chris, and the evidence comes from a 55-million-year-old amber deposit that was found near Paris in 1997. The team, led by Aquino Josang and the National Museum of Natural History in Paris, were studying this amber in the hope of working out which tree it came from, or which tree produced the resin which eventually turned into the amber, the fossilised resin. And while they were doing these studies, they ground up some of the amber into a powder and then extracted it with solvent, and were actually surprised to find a completely new structure, a natural product that had never been seen before.
And what was it?
It's a compound that they've named quesnoin, and it is of the diterpene family of natural products.
And why is this important?
Well, apart from the fact that it's an entirely new structure, the researchers believe that this is evidence, or further evidence, that Paris once had a tropical climate. They looked at the structure of this molecule, and which is a diterpene structure. This is a family of natural products that are found in all plants today. So they looked at the structure and tried to work out what might have been the chemical precursor for it. And they suggest that the precursor might be a structure called isooxic acid, which is only found in a tree from the Amazon rainforest called Hymenia oblongifolia. And so they suggest that the ancient ancestor of this Amazon tree must have been where this resin came from, and so Paris must have had a rather more tropical climate.
That, or could it have possibly been brought in from elsewhere beforehand and dumped in Paris? I don't mean by humans, I mean in terms of other geological processes.
It could have been. What these guys say is that when you look at plate tectonics theory, the landmass that is now Paris 55 million years ago was pretty close to the equator. So that sort of makes sense in terms of what sort of plants would have been growing there. If you take their argument that this isooxic acid is indeed the precursor, and a few of the chemists who I spoke to weren't convinced by their argument and suggested that there are other chemical precursors that could have made the structure as well.
But it sounds pretty convincing, doesn't it, that you've got a geological process putting this bit of the Earth's surface somewhere warm, so in other words, in the right place, at the right time, for this kind of tree to grow there?
Yes, that is true. But, in terms of the argument about where this structure might have actually come from, which I guess is more interesting to chemists, then, that might go on for a little bit longer. The structure looks like a pretty unlikely structure, and so the group suggests that it's actually the geological conditions that the amber could have been subjected to over 55 million years in terms of high heat and high pressure that made this pretty unlikely reaction occur to give you this structure in the first place.
So Paris was certainly a lot hotter in the past. Thanks very much, James. Now, Victoria, you got a whiffy question for us for this month's chemical conundrum. What's the answer?
I have indeed. We wanted to know, since natural gas doesn't smell, what is it that they add to it in order that you can smell a gas leak? And thanks very much to Jean Dallin and Dwai Krishnamurthy, who emailed in saying quite correctly that the molecule added to natural gas is mercaptan, also known as methane thiol. And it's a molecule that contains sulfur, which is what gives it its really horrible rotten egg, kind of cabbage type smell that we all associate with a gas leak. And it can be detected at very tiny quantities, just single parts per million, as low as one part per million, which is why it's added, so that gas leaks can be detected right at the beginning, keep you safe. So Jean Dallin and Dwai Krishnamurthy, we're going to send you out a Chemistry World bag of stuff. We haven't quite figured out what's going in it yet, but some
goodies. A free sample perhaps of mercaptan to go with.
That'd be nice. I'm sure we can come up with something that smells far nicer than that.
Well, that's reassuring, isn't it? So you don't get a whiffy goodie bag from the RSC. What have you got for us this month, Mark?
Well, this month, Chris, I'd like to know what makes safety matches safe. There's actually some really interesting chemistry behind it. So if you know the answer, email us at chemistryworld@rsc.org and you could get your hands on one of those very enticing-sounding goodie bags.
Thanks, Mark. And you can also use that email address if you'd like to drop us a line about the programme, which was brought to you this month by the Royal Society of Chemistry's Mark Peplow, Victoria Gill, Onono Bhattacharya and James Mitchell Crowe. The production was by Mira Senthilingam, and I'm Chris Smith. We're from thenakedscientist.com. Thank you for listening, and until next time, goodbye!
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.